This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. American cities have taken a beating this month. Los Angeles was hit by an earthquake. Several East Coast cities were virtually shut down last week by ice storms. My guest, James Treffel, is the author of A Scientist in the City, an examination of the scientific and technological developments that have made modern cities possible. The book also looks at some of the natural forces, like earthquakes, that can destroy what humans have created. Treffel is a professor of physics at George Mason University in Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. I asked Treffel what the earthquake and the ice storms got him thinking about.
I'll tell you, what they made me think about was medieval peasants. Because for most of recorded history, people have been aware that nature is a very dangerous thing. I mean, it's not a nice, fuzzy sort of Walt Disney movie. It's something that's very serious, and it's something that really doesn't care much about human beings. Now, we've surrounded ourselves with a technological cocoon that protects us from nature most of the time. And most people, when they think of nature, they think of, you know, going backpacking or going on a picnic and then getting back to a nice, comfortable apartment or house. For most of history, of course, people have lived out there all the time, and they would not have been surprised either by the earthquake or by the ice storms or the hurricanes or whatever else comes along, because they knew that's what nature was like.
I'll tell you one of the things I was thinking about. I was thinking, couldn't this city have done a better job? I live in Philadelphia, of cleaning and salting the streets. And then this week, now that we have about 50 water main breaks, and the water pressure is down around the city because so much water has escaped through the breaks, I've been thinking, well, the infrastructure is really old, and we're more vulnerable, perhaps, than we used to be in cities because of that.
That's true, because the point is that when you build something, I'm sure the people who laid those water mains weren't thinking about what was going to happen 50, 100 years in the future, because I suppose it never occurred to them that they would have that kind of life. But it's very expensive to go back and fix these things. There are political and economic reasons to keep using it until it breaks. And that's basically what's happened. Is we're not well equipped to deal with the kind of stress that comes along. And it'll show up, first of all, in these very highly stressful situations like storms and earthquakes.
Now, as you point out in your book, any discussion of cities in America almost turns into a religious debate.
Yes.
Cities are thought of as unnatural, and that there's some terrible price that we'll have to pay for living in them.
Yeah, that's part of it. One of the things I try to do in the book is to confront that point of view. Because there's nothing unnatural about a city. The city is an ecosystem, like any other ecosystem. If you go downtown in a city, which is a place that most people think of as the most unnatural, and you start asking, why is it unnatural? They'll say, well, there's no dirt, there are no plants here. But, that's not unnatural. There are lots of places in nature where there's no dirt and no plants. I think of cliffs and rock outcroppings and places like that. And in fact, the city is a place where wildlife that evolved to particular kinds of ecological niches that, in cliffs, for example, do very well. The first pigeons appeared in London in the 13th century when they started building tall church steeples. These were animals that had evolved to nest on the sides of cliffs. And of course, a side of a church is every bit as good as a side of a cliff. And most East Coast cities now have they're not only pigeons, but peregrine falcons are coming back. And they find the downtown Baltimore and New York are really very good places to live.
We were talking about how cities seem to almost build a cocoon that protects you from nature. But a lot of the technical advances that have made the city possible seem to actually defy the laws of nature. And I'm thinking specifically of the skyscraper.
Sure. Well, it's not an easy thing to build a skyscraper, and the ability to do so depends on some pretty sophisticated technologies. The most important one, though, is just how can you have a material that'll hold up that much weight?
Mm-hmm.
I see. With a wood building, you can go several stories, and then you get to a point where the wood just isn't strong enough to hold up anymore. With stone, you can go several hundred feet. The biggest cathedrals are sort of that size, and that's about the limit of what you can do with stone. And in the book, I talk about why that is. It ultimately, as a physicist, I always have to bring it back to atoms and bonds between atoms. But basically, it's the kind of materials you have. Now, steel is a different kind of material. It's very strong, and it's relatively lightweight for its strength. And in the late 19th century, people learned how to make large amounts of it. Once you have a material that can hold up the weight, then the next question you ask is, can I now build a building much higher than was done before? And this actually started in America, primarily in Chicago, around the turn of the century. People began erecting buildings that were had steel frames. You see, there are two sort of strategies you can use to put up a building. I think of them as lobsters and as human beings. The lobster strategy is to build real thick walls that just hold the weight up, just like the lobster has an exoskeleton, a very hard exoskeleton. But our bodies are different. You know, our weight is held up by an internal skeleton, and the outer covering of our body doesn't support our weight. We have skin on the outside. In modern skyscrapers, what happens is that the internal skeleton is made of steel, and then you can coat the outside with anything you like, usually just glass. And of course, the glass doesn't have to hold anything up. It just has to let light in and keep the weather out.
Another aspect of the physics of skyscrapers that I found fascinating in your book was that the higher you get in a skyscraper, the more of the building is swayed by the wind.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is a little scary, actually, if you allow yourself to think about it. But the top of the Empire State Building in a good wind will move back and forth a couple of feet. Now, it'll move slowly, so you're not aware of it. But the best analogy I can think of is, you think of an antenna on the back of a car that's riding around. The antenna can whip around. You can make steels that are very strong that won't break when they're being whipped around like that. But on the other hand, you wouldn't want to ride on the end of that antenna. And so one of the things that people who are building skyscrapers have to do is, even though the steel is strong enough so that if a big wind comes, a skyscraper can just sway like a tree, the people who are in it can't deal with that. So they have to. There are many different strategies for keeping it rigid, keeping it from moving too much in the wind.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Treffel, a physicist who's the author of the new book, A Scientist in the City. Jim, let's look at the Los Angeles earthquake a little bit, which did so much to damage the city and which is a really frightening, compelling example of how the elements, about how nature can destroy what man has worked so hard to build. We were just talking about skyscrapers. My basic impulse would be, not knowing anything about science, that the taller the building, the more vulnerable it is. Is that true in an earthquake?
Actually, I thought that too, but it turns out not to be true. I have a very good friend who's one of this very small company of people who are licensed to design buildings in earthquake zones, and she and I went on tour of San Francisco just after the earthquake there. And I looked at these skyscrapers on the hills in San Francisco, and I have to say that the hills of San Francisco by themselves are kind of scary to me. If you've ever driven on them, and you know, you sort of come over the top and it looks like you're going straight down. And I was absolutely sure that with these big skyscrapers sitting on top of the hills must have been just actually the worst places to be. And she says that's not true, and it's a very interesting reason why it's not true. It doesn't have much to do with the building, but it has to do with the kind of ground it's on. And the analogy that I like to use is to imagine you have a cement birdbath that's filled with Jell-O. And if you start tapping on the side of the birdbath with a hammer, the Jell-O will start tossing around. Now, what's going on there is you're bringing energy in. You're sending waves into the system through the cement and into the Jell-O. That's just what an earthquake does. It sends waves through the ground. But the Jell-O moves a lot, and the cement doesn't move. And so the question is not how much energy is going in or how big are the waves, but how does the ground move in response to that? And that depends on the kind of materials you have. So in some parts of San Francisco, for example, down near the bay that were filled in, so you had very loose ground, that was like being on Jell-O. The ground moved a lot, and the houses, there was a great deal of destruction. Up on the hills, the houses are anchored to bedrock. That's like being in the cement, and the ground just doesn't move very much. So as a matter of fact, it turns out that that's not one of the places your intuition helps you. I was very surprised to learn that.
So theoretically, your safety in a building depends more on what the building is built on.
Well, on that,
assuming the building is well built.
Yeah. Now, but the other thing is that we have only learned about how to design for earthquakes. This is something that's an ongoing learning process. It's funny, but every once in a while, there's a big disaster that leads to new technologies. In 1950, there was a big earthquake in El Centro in California, down in the southern part of the state. And it was the first earthquake that people actually had instruments around where they could measure things like how much the land moved and how much energy was going through and so forth. And that was the beginning of the earthquake building codes. And so that's really only, you know, what, half a century that we've had experience at getting at what earthquakes can do to buildings and designing buildings so they'll be safe. And a lot of the buildings in San Francisco, for example, or in Los Angeles, are somewhat older buildings. They were built before these codes went into effect. And when a big earthquake comes along, of course, they're very vulnerable.
What are some of the other scientific principles that determine how well a building is going to hold up in an earthquake?
Well, there are basically two strategies you can follow. One is to try to keep the building rigid. So you think of, for example, a small house. If you can keep all the corners square, then when the ground's moving, the house just kind of bounces around like a boat on the ocean, but the house doesn't collapse. What they do now in California is they require in all small houses that once they put up the walls, that they put a solid sheath of plywood around it. And that's actually a fairly strong material. Tall buildings, the strategy is to let it sway. It's sort of the oak tree strategy, that the building will move around, it'll sway, but if it's made properly, it won't break. And so that, and if you also design it so things don't fall off of it and things and hurt people underneath. But in fact, those skyscrapers in downtown Los Angeles, are the new ones anyway, are probably pretty safe places to be in an earthquake.
In San Francisco and in Los Angeles during the earthquakes, elevated freeways broke.
Yes.
What are some of the scientific principles behind freeway construction in earthquake areas?
Well, it's not so much scientific principles as it's almost common sense when you start thinking about it. But when you have an elevated freeway, what you've got is you've got a big weight balanced on a very thin support, mm-hmm. usually. And the support, if it's made out of cement, you can't bend it. You can't, shift it around much. It'll snap. Now, the way they've built these things in the last 10 or 15 years is that if you could see inside the support of a bridge, a freeway bridge, for example, what you'd see would be kind of a basket of steel reinforcing rods in there. The idea being that if the thing starts to shake and you break the cement, that the basket will hold the concrete there so the structure won't collapse. Now, you'll have to rebuild it afterwards, but nobody will get killed in that process. But this is a fairly new thing, and there are a lot of freeways around that were built before these codes were put in. And those are the ones that are collapsing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is physicist James Treffel, author of the new book, A Scientist in the City, which examines cities through the eyes of science and technology. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Treffel, and we're talking about the developments of science and technology that have made modern cities possible. He's the author of the new book, A Scientist in the City. Is it fair to say that you think the two new technologies that will do the most to shape the future of cities are new developments in mass transit and new information technologies?
Yeah, the information technology is the real joker in this pack. Basically, the way I've sort of come down on this is I look at the three different threads of technology from the past. One is we've already talked about the ability to manipulate atoms, that is, making new kinds of materials. The other is the ability to control energy, and that includes transportation and other kinds of energy. Those are pretty mature. I think the one critical technology there is the electric car, but that's going to happen. I mean, that's already well underway. Then the third technology is information transfer, the idea that you can take information, put it into electronic form, and move it around at the speed of light. And that's brand new because we've only had historically speaking, we've only had a machine that can manipulate energy in that form, the computer, for a relatively short time. And it's almost, I don't think anybody who's writing or thinking about this today is going to get it right. I think that when this develops, it's going to be so wild. It's like living in 1830 and trying to figure out what the electrical generator is going to do. You can't conceive of what the kind of society is going to be like.
One of the developments in mass transportation that you look at in your book is the possibility of magnetic levitation trains.
Oh yeah, this is a wonderful technology. It's a technology that if it didn't exist, you'd almost have to invent it. Let me explain. Should I take a minute and explain what it is?
Yeah. Do they exist yet, or are they just?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh, they do.
There are prototype trains. They've been running for 15 years in both Japan and Germany. And they've been used at places like industrial exhibitions, and there was a big fair in Yokohama and I think a fair in Manchester. They've carried millions of people as kind of a curiosity.
Uh-huh.
And just to give you a sense of this, the first proposal for a maglev, magnetically levitated train in the United States is supposed to go from Orlando Airport to Disney World. But basically what this is, it's a... what limits the speed of trains now is the fact that they have wheels that develop friction along the tracks. And so conventional trains can't go much more than a few hundred miles an hour. And in fact, they normally go at about 120, between 100 and 150 miles an hour. The magnetically levitated train actually has magnets inside of it, and it runs over a metal sheet, and then there are various laws of physics that tell you that when you get a situation like that, the train will be pushed up. There'll be a magnetic force that actually pushes the train up off the track. So these things float, well, maybe 6 inches above a metal track. And in effect, they're sort of guided airplanes, if you want to think of them that way. But they can, because they don't touch the ground, they can, you can talk about speeds of 300 miles an hour and more. And so there's a general rule that city planners and developers know. It's called the rule of 45. And it says that nobody will travel, or most people will not travel more than 45 minutes in one direction, either to go to work or to go shopping or anything like that. And this is an important tool that people use when they figure out where they're going to put shopping centers and so forth. But if you're going 300 miles an hour, I mean, that, you can go a long way in 45 minutes, and you can begin getting situations where if people want to live in a city, they can live, you know, 200 miles away and actually commute on a daily basis. So it's a kind of transportation that's really well suited to the dispersed city, much more so than conventional trains or airplanes or anything except the automobile, actually.
I don't know if you'll be able to address this as a physicist or not, but I personally feel like I've lost a lot of my faith in the future. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, in the future I could look ahead to these magnetically levitated trains and so on. In the present, I'm faced with the fact that I had a whole lot of trouble just getting to work last week because the trains were crippled by the ice. Mm. And this week, there's all these water main breaks in the city of Philadelphia where I live, and the toilets will barely flush, and the shower is a mere trickle. And I feel, well, I'll be really lucky if I can get to work and take a shower and flush my toilet in the next few days. And I feel technologically somehow the things are going more backwards than forwards. And then you even look at a place, well, okay, Los Angeles is suffering from the earthquake. You look at a city like Sarajevo, which is being devastated by war and being thrown back to an era of hundreds of years ago in terms of what they're physically capable of doing. And you wonder, well, are the days of really thinking about the future and what science can do for us almost over?
I don't characterize myself necessarily as a technological optimist. But what I've tried to do in the book is this. I've noticed that in the past, the kinds of cities we could build have always been limited by our technological capabilities. What's happened in the last 50 years, almost without anyone noticing, is that those limits have receded so far into the distance that, for all practical purposes, we can build any city we want, provided we're willing to pay for it and provided we know what we want. Now, those are two things that, as a physicist, I don't have any particular expertise in. But it's clear to me that there's going to have to be a major investment in fixing or rebuilding, if you like, the infrastructure in cities that already exist. And this is not a trivial problem because, just to give you one example, you've mentioned the water mains. The town where I spend my summers, Red Lodge, Montana, recently went through this. They started going down the street and pulling out the old water mains, and some of them were actually hollow logs that were put in, you know, in 1890. Well, again, the people who, that's not the fault of the people who built those water mains. I'm sure it never crossed their mind that they'd still be carrying water 100 years in the future. But it's always cheaper not to fix things. You know, it's always cheaper just to kind of let things go until they collapse, particularly public things where you have to expend public money to do it. And I think we're going to have to change that attitude somewhat. And I think the way it's going to happen is actually what's happening here, because I'll bet a couple of years from now there's going to be a fairly big project in Philadelphia to fix the water lines. There certainly will be in D.C. And what that means is that some of these kind of future things that I'm talking about are going to take a little longer to get here. But, a city never develops in just one way. There are always, you know, a million things going on at the same time. And I'll bet at the same time that the water mains are being fixed downtown, there are going to be new office buildings going up in the edge cities and the suburbs, and new kinds of developments going on elsewhere that are the kinds of things I'm talking about.
Having finished your book, do you feel more respectful of how cities are built or more fearful about their destruction?
I'm not worried about the destruction of cities. In fact, the fact that I'm writing the book now rather than 10 years ago, I think I don't have to think about nuclear war as much as I would have then. And so I think one of the great threats to the world cities, which is a threat of a nuclear conflagration, that's no longer there. And that, to me, that's a sign of tremendous hope. And you know, I think people are able to solve problems. And I think when the problems confront society in a way that they can't be evaded, you know, like your water main problem in Philadelphia, they do get fixed.
In the urban ecosystem, there are sometimes big surprises. Mm-hmm. For instance, in Philadelphia, there's a deer problem.
Yes.
In the city, in the outskirts of the city. It's because we have a wonderful park that runs through more mm-hmm. or less the length of the city.
Yes.
And I know there's a driveway. There's a drive that I take from my home into town, and several times I've had to, like, slam on the brakes because of a deer crossing the road.
Of course, yeah.
And this is within the city limits. And the deer have actually become a problem to people's gardens, to new growth in the area. And it's the city's in a real quandary. What does it do? Does it kill off the deer? Mm-hmm. Nobody feels very warmly toward that. On the other hand, the deer are becoming a real problem.
That's right. The deer are a good example. Dandelion is another good example mm-hmm. of animals which, or of organisms which evolved to fill a particular ecological niche and then found out that mankind was providing them with just the perfect place to live. Now, deer, there are a lot more deer in the United States today, by the way, than there were when Europeans first came here. Hmm. And deer are basically animals that can exploit the edge of a forest. That's what they do very well. And, of course, a suburb has lots of edges. And, you know, human activity produces lots of forest edges that weren't there before. And so, yes, of course, the deer population booms. All the natural predators, the wolves and so forth, don't exist in those places anymore. And I think we're going to have to bite the bullet. That's maybe the wrong terminology to use, but I think they simply will have to be eliminated.
Well, James Treffel, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us a bit about the science and technology of cities. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
James Treffel is the author of the new book, A Scientist in the City. He's a physicist who teaches at George Mason University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.